privilege of gathering in your name, for the friendship you've given us and the unity that we have in you. Help us, Father, as we study your word this morning, as we just lift our hearts to you this morning, let it be pleasing to you. In Christ's name, amen. Okay, I want to do something a little experimental here. Don't hope nobody gets too nervous about this, but we're going to continue in Genesis. In fact, we're ready to talk about the seventh day of creation. But in preparation for that, I would like to read a psalm. And last week we mentioned in passing that Psalm 104 was recommended reading. And any of you who had an opportunity to do that will just get more out of this, because we're going to read Psalm 104. Because I think it's just such a beautiful, beautiful statement. A word picture of what God did in the 6 days of creation that we've just finished talking about. And so I've been so blessed by it that I hope that you can be blessed by it too. What I recommend, and again, you can do whatever you want to do, but you may want to just kind of close your eyes and just visualize what the psalmist is saying, because it is said so beautifully, so magnificent, and the glory of God that is expressed through this psalm with regard to creation is just keenly present. So again, you know, feel free to close your eyes, just think about these words as the psalmist gives them to us. Psalm 104. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, Thou art very great. Thou art clothed with splendor and majesty, covering Thyself with light as with a cloak, stretching out heaven like a tent curtain. He lays the beams of His upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds His chariot. He walks upon the wings of the wind. He makes the winds His messengers, flaming fire His ministers. He established the earth upon its foundation so that it will not totter forever and ever. Thou didst cover it with the deep as with a garment. The waters were standing above the mountains. At Thy rebuke they fled. At the sound of Thy thunder they hurried away. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which Thou didst establish for them. Thou didst set a boundary that they may not pass over, that they may not return to cover the earth. He sends forth springs in the valleys. They flow between the mountains. They give drink to every beast of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them the birds of the heavens dwell. They lift up their voices among the branches. He waters the mountains from His upper chambers. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of His works. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the labor of man, so that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine which makes man's heart glad, so that he may make his face glisten with oil, the food which sustains man's heart. The trees of the Lord drink their fill, the cedars of Lebanon which He planted, where the birds build their nests, and the stork whose home is the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The cliffs are the refuge for the rock badgers. He made the moon for the seasons. The sun knows the place of its setting. Thou dost appoint darkness, and it becomes night, in which all the beasts of the forest prowl about, in which all the young lions roar after their prey and seek their food from God. When the sun rises, they withdraw and lie down in the dens. Man goes forth to his work and to his labor until evening. O Lord, how many are thy works! In wisdom thou hast made them all. The earth is full of thy possessions. There is the sea, great and broad, in which are swarms without numbers, animals both great and small. There are ships move. There the ships move along in Leviathan, which thou hast formed to sport in it. Leviathan is the whale. They all wait for thee to give them their food in due season. Thou dost give to them. They gather it up. Thou dost open thy hand. They are satisfied with good. Thou dost hide thy face. They are dismayed. Thou dost take away their spirit. They expire and return to the dust. Thou dost send forth thy spirit. They are created. And thou dost renew the face of the ground. Let the glory of the Lord endure forever. Let the Lord be glad in his works. He looks at the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praise to my God while I have my being. Let my meditation be pleasing to him. As for me, I shall be glad in the Lord. Let sinners be consumed from the earth. Let the wicked be no more. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Praise the Lord. I think when we are confronted, when we're faced with the reality of God's awesomeness, it can so often be a little wake-up call. So often we get so entwined in the things of our lives, the things that are going on each day, the troubles that we face, the heartaches, the anxieties, the challenges of making a living every day, the challenges of keeping out of trouble, the challenges of trying to avoid self-destruction. But the fact is, God has all of this, all that we see and more than what we see, both from the things that we learn as we explore more and more of the universe, and the things that we learn as we explore more and more of the microscopic and submicroscopic worlds, and all of that which has order and beauty, sprinkled with a lot of the awesome power of God, is a reminder to us that God has done all of it, that He's done it all. And if we have any doubts, if we have any doubts at all, where can they possibly go? In other words, a doubt that says, well, gee, is there really a God? Give me another explanation. You can't find them. And we've talked about the creation of the animals. We've talked about creation of the fish and the fowl and all of these different things. And we have people making their lame attempts, their faltering attempts at trying to describe it all, trying to say, here's how it happened naturally without God. And yet even those things are just tiny little pieces. The taxonomy of the biological realm is just a tiny, tiny little piece of all of God's creation. The majesty that He's describing here in Psalm 104 is a majesty that goes way beyond the foolish little theories that we come up with in the science world. God's awesomeness is beyond anything we can imagine. For me, I see no other theory. I see no other explanation that makes any sense. All the others are dark. All the others are hopeless. All of the others lead people to either total self-absorption or following fairy tales that don't seem to make any sense at all. The God of the universe has indeed shown His hand. He has indeed exposed who He is to mankind. He has done it through His creation. He has done it through His personal work with each of us, where we have this desire inside to know God, desire inside to follow God. And we almost have to fight that desire inside, or we have to quench it, or we have to flee from it in order to exercise some sort of sense of doubt. Well, in the creation story, we talked about those 6 days, and we talked about what God has done there, and we've made it very clear that we don't really know whether these were absolutely literal, or whether these days were done in where it represented millions of years, or what happened. Many, many different explanations are available, all of which still glorify God the Creator. And now at the beginning of chapter 2, we have a very curious passage and something that has a lot of depth to it beyond just what it seems. It says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were completed, and their hosts." The hosts meaning, in this case, the word probably is referring to just everything, all the things that are in the earth. Including human beings and the animals and the stars and the everything that's in the heavens. And by the seventh day, God completed His work which He had done. And He rested on the seventh day from all His work which He had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it He rested from all His work which God had created and had made. And that's the end of the seventh day. The implications of what has just been said here are much, much deeper than I really had thought about before, as I was kind of pondering this day and these verses. And it came to mind Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews chapter 4, actually chapters 3 and 4, refer back to this creation story and put it into a completely different context that we don't commonly, although that certainly the scholars, I've found that some of at least the more time-honored scholars, Kyle and Dalich, some guys who some of you are familiar with, who had done a translation. They have like 20 volumes on the Old Testament, and it's very scholarly work and very glorious work, a work that just glorifies Jesus Christ and a study of the Old Testament. It's beautiful work. And they also just made some reference to Hebrews 4, and not as much depth as we're going to talk about, but there really seem to be three different levels of application of God resting on this seventh day. And we're going to get to Hebrews 4, but before we do, there's a couple other levels. Now, certainly, we understand that when the law came, when Moses was given the commandments. One of the commandments was to keep the Sabbath. Right? That was one of the commandments. Now that was kind of a temporary thing. What's interesting is that, that happened in the midst of when they were in the middle of the wilderness on their way to the promised land. They had some detours along the way and took quite a few years to get to the promised land. But God had given them those commandments to in a fairly detailed way, and then gave them more interpretations of them to boot. And probably to just keep them from self-destructing. A lot of people talk about the law, and we're going to talk about it a little bit here, but the law, the Jewish law, was apparently given so that the Jews would not go the same way as all of their surrounding neighbors in that area. And that way being a way of ultimately just being completely absorbed back into the earth. Now, there's things called tells over in the Middle Eastern area particularly. A tell is a big mound. It kind of looks like a hill. But it's a hill of man-made wreckage. Not a garbage dump per se, but it's the wreckage of cities, civilization. In fact, typically back in those times, you would go, if you destroyed a city, let's say you'd conquered a city, you took it over, well, you would just, reduce it to rubble, but then you would build on that rubble, because you got some foundations there, you got a lot of building materials, and so you would build on top of that. And then somebody else would come and conquer you, destroy your city, and they'd build on top of your rubble. Then somebody else would come along, and there are layers, some 20 different civilizations, if you want to call it, that deep, where the archaeologists try to figure out, well, which part was part of which civilization, which particular building period, and they try to date history. It's really complicated, and most of the theories that come out of it have a lot of doubt to them, or a lot of uncertainty, just because of that complication. But anyway, the point is that the Jews were destined, just because of the way that everybody else went, to just become another big mound of rubble. And it would have been, that's what happened with all the other civilizations back there. Some exceptions in Egypt, but aside from that, that's about it. So what happened is God gives them this set of laws, and those laws, by observing them, they would have the chance of at least being preserved long enough for God to send the Messiah, which of course he did. So we had a few, several hundred years in that, in the time, I don't know, it could have been as much as, about 2,000, maybe 2,500 years, somewhere around there. That some of your texts may have some better dating than my memory can recall. But they needed to survive. They didn't survive. The Messiah was not going to come through that means, and God was going to make sure that the Messiah was coming through the nation of Israel. God also was going to assure that you had this family whose history would be recorded, and that history would be a history of many, many different ways of trying to follow God. Most of the ways having failed. And so the law was given to preserve at least some semblance of that history. Now it was God's law, and it certainly was right, and even today, as years go on, we learn more and more about the wisdom of the law, the Ten Commandments, and the other things that the Jews derived from those commandments, and other things that are certainly written in the book of the law, the first five books of Moses, particularly. One of those is observing the Sabbath. And when Moses gave that commandment, or God gave the commandment through Moses, he refers back to this creation story. Let me just turn to that for a moment. Exodus chapter 20. It says, remember the Sabbath and to keep it holy. The seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God, and in it you shall not do any work. You or your son or your daughter, your male or female servant, or your cattle, or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. What has he done? He's referred right back to his creation story. You know, when they refer back to the creation story, we don't have a whole lot of excuse to say, well, this is just a cultural thing. You know, there's several things like that in the Scripture. If we ever want to try to avoid having to think about, oh, well, gee, that was just a cultural thing, that was just for that period. If it relates back to the creation story, got no foundation for it being a cultural thing. It's part of the essence, the beginnings of what God has put together. So, in this particular commandment to the Jews, and this was specifically to the Jews, it was laid out as a very specific detail, he refers back to the creation story. Now the Jews took that and they made it very rigid. I mean, we talked about the blue laws that we used to have, which probably were not so bad, by the way. Where people, you know, weren't able to be open on Sunday even. And in fact, when we lived in England, they still have, to a very large extent, that at least custom. There's a few places here and there that stay open, but I mean, the shops are closed, almost everything is closed on Sunday. And you have to plan ahead. I mean, we had to learn to plan ahead. Oh my gosh, you know, we can't, when they had to buy milk a couple days ahead of time, you know, it's really tough. But actually, I think they would open, some of the little Indian shops would be open, the little things that we would call 7-Elevens, you know, but they were just little things. They would be open, and in London, in the Indian sector, it was open 7 days a week. That's just the way things were. But the rest of England, it was closed. A lot of a lot of Europe observes the same kind of thing. We observed it in our country. Well, we've changed, in Southern California particularly. You know, everything is available 7 days a week, practically. But the Jews were actually adhering to it by law. Now, before this, they were already adhering to it. God had already made it a holy day. You notice he said God sanctified it. He rested the seventh day, and he blessed it and sanctified it. In other words, he had already established that as a principle. It was already there. But obviously, it wasn't working. And when God had to establish the laws that would preserve Israel, he had to get it very specifically down in writing because they weren't able to adhere to it. Now, when Jesus came along, he kind of expanded things a bit. He brought to light what God really intended. Jesus honored the Sabbath. Now, that's important for us to understand. He did honor the Sabbath. The Sabbath is apparently something that God has established and God did sanctify. Now, don't get afraid here. I'm not going to set up say that there's some new law of the Sabbath for the harvest and mission. I mean, none of you would observe it anyway, you know. But the fact is, God did establish a day. The principle of rest. And actually, it's kind of interesting. Isaiah defines it a little more clearly, and which is of course the same definition that Jesus gave to it. Let's see, it's Isaiah 48, I think. Yeah, 58. Isaiah 58. Now, Isaiah is prophesying at the time when Israel was falling apart. I mean, it was towards the end. God had indeed preserved them for many, many hundreds of years. But they had constantly been a problem. constantly, just like us, all right? They're no different than the rest of us human beings. They just couldn't seem to, by their own measures at least, hang on to God. They wanted to go to all these different idols and try to look like all the other nations and all this kind of stuff. You know, it was kind of reminded me, as we were driving in, I hope I don't step on anybody's toes here, but don't think I will. We were driving over here on the Pomona Freeway and we passed this urban assault vehicle, you know, this really nice four-wheel drive unit. And I noticed it's a Lexus. Now maybe some of you already know this, but you know, I mean, it's one thing, we all, you know, we like our four-wheel drive vehicles and stuff, and that's great, and that's become the thing. But now, and here's one that is so, I mean, this is like the top, this is the Rolls Royce of four-wheel drive Jeeps, right? I mean, it's incredible. Lexus on it. Now, why do you need a Lexus four-wheel drive Jeep, you know? Now, I mean, there's people I had to pay $70,000-$80,000 for. I don't know how much it costs. But, and it's so comical to me. And it's human. It's a thing we do. Well, why do people do that? Because they want to be seen driving a Lexus. That's it. There's no other functional reason. If you wanted a functional reason, you'd get a Land Cruiser if you really wanted the, you know, a real high-end, super reliable job. And those, of course, became the big thing. I remember when our next-door neighbor's son and daughter got married, and they're just young kids. One of the first things they did is go out and buy a $35,000 Toyota Land Cruiser, you know. Shiny black and everything is perfect. Why? Because, you know, they want them to look successful, and that's it. Well, it's not successful enough to be driving a $35,000 Land Cruiser. If you really want to look successful, it's got to be a Lexus. Right now it's the same automobile, but you just got a different name, and you pay an extra 10, 15, 20, I don't know how many thousand dollars you pay for it. Well, it's a thing. It's a thing in our heads. We want to be seen. We so often are attracted to living for what other people think of us. That's human nature. And the Jews did the same thing. They got swept up into living for what other people thought of them. And that was one of the things that caused their destruction. So Isaiah is talking right at the time that the Jews are, that the northern 10 tribes are getting conquered and swept away into Assyria. The southern tribes are just right on the brink of getting swept away into Babylon. And God still is in control. I mean, he's going to, you know, 70 years he's going to leave them in Babylon. They're going to come back and kind of get another start. And that would establish the next round of history, and again, in preparation for the Messiah to come. But the point is, Isaiah is talking about what it's really supposed to be like. Not just these petty observations of some laws that have been kind of refined and refined again and refined again. Yeah, you only take 30 steps on the Sabbath, and you know, you can't do this and you can't do that. And that was just totally off of what God intended. And here's what Isaiah says. In fact, in chapter 58 overall is a marvelous statement of what God really wants from people, not the observance of petty rituals. In fact, it's a great chapter for this whole thing. In fact, most of it talks about fasts and people fasting for this as a ritual. And in fact, he says, in fact, I'll go back to there. He says, is this not the fast which I choose? To loosen the bonds of wickedness, to undo the bands of the yoke and let the oppressed go free and break every yoke? Is it not to divide your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into the house? When you see the naked, to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh. And he says, then your light will break out like the dawn, and your recovery will speedily spring forth, and your righteousness will go before you. The glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. In other words, this is the kind of righteousness God is interested in. He doesn't care about these rituals, these little things that we do to try to look holy. And this is what he says about the Sabbath, verse 13. If because of the Sabbath you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy day of the Lord honorable, and shall honor it, desisting from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure, and speaking your own word, then you will take delight in the Lord. And I will make you ride on the heights of the earth, and I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob your father. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. What's he saying? He's saying the Sabbath. Isaiah defines the Sabbath, and thereby, I'm assuming, the rest on the Sabbath. In other words, the Sabbath day's rest. Says, from doing your own pleasure. Seeking your own pleasure. He says it twice. Speaking your own word. Being, again, self-absorbed. Our society is so totally centered on what we can do for ourselves, how we can extract the most we possibly can for number one, that even we Christians have trouble with this. Even we Christians have trouble with this. I mean, I like to play tennis on Sundays, you know, now and then, when my future son-in-law is able, you know. I'd like to do some other things. I find myself I typically, unfortunately, kind of gotten into a habit of doing a couple hours of stuff I couldn't get done at the office on Sunday afternoons and different things. And there's things that we do. And I know I have to police myself. We've had a joke in our household for a long time because, and most of you know that we're kind of obsessed with continuing to be fruitful and multiply, you know, not so much having more children, Lord forbid, but just trying to just keep going. We're just always building or doing something or trying to refurbish something. That's just kind of part of our being. And there have been times that I've let it spill over into Sunday now and then. We have this little joke because it seems that every time I do, something goes wrong. I get hurt, or everything falls apart, whatever I did takes three times as long. Now I don't know whether this is just in my mind or not, but the fact is that as I read the scripture and as I see what's going on here, we ought to be considering at least one day a week as a day of doing something different, one day that we're not caught up in trying to eke out a living. One day to kick back a little, but not into self-absorption, and that's what's interesting. Not into self-absorption, but into thinking about other people. Now, if you have a family, that's great. A day, fathers particularly. We fathers love to get kind of caught up in our own little world, our own little thing, our own little diversions. Our form of selfishness, typically, is to go off and do our thing. Forget about everybody else. We want to go play, you know. We want to go play golf, or we want to go play with our computers, or we want to go play something where we don't have to relate to a whole lot of people, but we can kind of compete or do something that's kind of macho, you know, something that we can do. Or we want to go off, we want to go hiking. Something where we are into ourselves or kind of out on our own and we don't have to relate to anybody else. That's our form of selfishness. Women have a different form of selfishness. We won't get into that at the moment. But one of the things that... We've talked about it before. That's right. But the idea of, if you've got a family, spending that dedicated day for them. Let it be for them. That's what he's talking. It's not for yourself, and that's what Isaiah is saying. Let's don't get caught up in trying to do everything for ourselves. Let's at least set aside one day where we're not doing everything for us, where other people are important to us. Now, the benefit of that is that we groom the relationships that ultimately give us far more satisfaction than getting our handicap down by a stroke or two, you know. or getting a higher score on that stupid video game, or reading another mystery novel or science fiction novel that we thought gave us more. And we have all these things that we want to do, but they just totally pale in significance compared to grooming our relationships. And what Isaiah is talking about here is take care of the relationships. Not just with our friends and family, because that's important, but also if God has put us in a position where we are confronted with people in need, let us respond to those needs. That's a good thing to do. Now, this is particularly appropriate back in more ancient days where leisure time wasn't that easy to come by. People, you say, well, why shouldn't you take care of the poor 6 days a week? No, I mean, most people are just eking out a living, foraging for food the other 6 days of the week, just trying to literally survive. Who's got time to do more? But God is saying that we can set aside a day, that He designated from the foundations of the earth, setting aside a day. No, it doesn't have to be this Saturday or Sunday or whatever a day it is. That's not necessarily a scriptural requirement. But setting it aside a day is a good thing to do. It's a day for the Lord. What does that mean? Again, taking care of relationships. Not a day to become self-absorbed, a day of taking care of relationships, taking care of looking at the larger things of life, the important things of life. That doesn't mean you can't go and play. I mean, going and spending a couple hours on that. I mean, I can play tennis without guilt. I really can, you know? We can do so. And you can't get dogmatic about this stuff. It's a principle we're talking about, not a part of the penal code, you know? It's not a city ordinance. Now, Jesus observed it exactly that way. Jesus constantly, I mean, he was brought before the Jewish leaders because he healed on the Sabbath. They didn't like that. In fact, they were going to stone him for doing that. Many times he healed on the Sabbath. He continued to do different things. At one point, they picked grain on the Sabbath, going through a field, picked some grain and ate it. Why? Because they were hungry. And there was grain. It was food. If you take food and eat it, you're not hungry. It's a very simple thing. And he was accused, oh, you're doing work on the Sabbath. He's saying, come on now, Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The idea is, it's a day for us. It is a day for man. It is a day that God didn't somehow try to establish something where man would be imprisoned to some, special little set of codes or laws, but instead he gave principles to man so that man could survive, man and indeed thrive. So, on the one hand, we have the Jewish law that set up the Sabbath, and that was very specific, and it tied right back to what God had done. On the second hand, we have what a more exalted understanding of the Sabbath that is available and really applies to us today as well. And that is still this day that God has sanctified and a day to think about relationships, a day to not be completely caught up in our own selves, but certainly not to allow ourselves into the trap of working 7 days a week, but instead, let's take a day off. Take a day off from that to do the more important things in life. Now, by the way, it is interesting because all through the Old Testament and the New Testament, it was assumed that people work in 6 days a week. It's only recent, fairly modern society that has gone down to five, and now recently we're trying to get down to four, 6 days a week. It's commonplace. We've joined the rest of the world when we have to do that. I'm not necessarily saying that everybody should become a workaholic like some of us, but nevertheless, don't think it's unusual, cruel and unusual punishment to have to work more than 40 hours a week. Now, what's the third application? The third application, which is the most glorious of all, is what we're given in the book of Hebrews. And I'm only going to say this briefly. I'm not going to go through a long time, so don't get worried here. Karen always accused me of preaching multiple sermons. You know? In Hebrews chapter 4, the writer talks about entering into the rest of God. The rest meaning the Sabbath day rest. In other words, God created the world in 6 days and then He rested. And the writer to the Hebrews says, let me pick up in verse 9. There's a lot of background in Hebrews 3 and chapter 4. But he says, there remains before, therefore, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest has himself also rested from his works as God did from his. Let us therefore be diligent to enter that rest, lest anyone fall through following the same example of disobedience. Now, what's the example of disobedience? The context here is Paul, or whoever the writer is, many people think it's Paul, but we don't really know. He's talking about the Jews. He's talking about the Jews as they were in the wilderness, getting all caught up in their own complaints. Radical complaints. One thing about complaints is they fuel more complaints. You get a few people complaining, and the more people complain, and more people complain, it's infectious. And you see that in the workplace all the time, and it certainly happened to the Jews. This infectious complaining as they were going around the wilderness. Now, don't get me wrong, it was a tough situation, and I probably would have complained too, because it was, you know, they didn't even know where the next meal was going to come from at this point. And so they're complaining. Well, it became a very bitter, bitter time. In fact, it's called the Pekrosmos, which is the Greek word for bitterness, the day of bitterness. In fact, the Hebrew word, Masah, I think it is, and Meribah. Meribah and Masah, which both mean bitterness and anguish. And he's talking about this time. And God had to destroy a great many of the children of Israel as a result of that. And he says they didn't enter into his rest. He says, well, why not? What was the problem? The problem was they were trying to observe the law, but without faith, without trust in God. They were trying to go about observing this rule and this rule and this rule and this rule, but there was not that fundamental trust that God was the one who was going to have to take care of them and would take care of them. And so chapter 4 talks about that very issue of the fact that we enter into God's rest by trust in Him. What does that mean? When Jesus said, peace I leave to you, in John 14, peace I leave to you, my peace I give to you, not as the world gives it, do I give it to you. The peace of Christ that surpasses understanding is also part of this rest as is exposed here in the book of Hebrews. The peace of Christ, as we live with God and get that experience of peace that can only come by trust in Him, is a precursor to that Sabbath day rest. And what it leads to is the ultimate rest. The ultimate rest of eternity with God that is also referred to as the Sabbath day rest. What does that mean? That gives us hope. Not only do we have rest because we have peace with Christ available, but we also have this rest that comes from having complete assurance that we will enter in ultimately to that ultimate rest with God for eternity. We will be delivered from our anxieties. We will be delivered from our weaknesses. We will be delivered from all the hassles of living on this earth. Romans chapter 8 makes that real clear. All creation groans and travails until the present day, awaiting adoption. And we ourselves, who have the first fruits, in this case of salvation, we also groan in ourselves, waiting for that redemption. But the very fact that we know there's redemption, that we know that there is this Sabbath day rest that he's talking about, this ultimate rest with God, gives us the ability to endure. So we have the peace with Christ. Now, we have the assurance, otherwise known as hope, for the future. And we have God's guidance of what this Sabbath, what it means, of setting aside, at least for now, a certain day to remember the Lord. A certain day sanctified for God, where we do take a break from the otherwise anxious cares of life and present that to God. Okay, we'll stop there. Father, it's so beyond us to comprehend what it is that you have intended for mankind, but you've left us this record, and Lord, we're trying to understand what you want, trying to understand what you have in store. And Lord, one thing we do see, and that is your constant outreach to man to offer rest, to offer peace. Lord, this is so contrary to the way our culture goes, our society goes, that it's hard for us to understand. It's hard for us to know what it means. We just ask you to teach us, as only you can, to know what we individually must do, can do, to enjoy your peace, to enjoy your rest,